Merle Curdy on June 24th, 1992. And we have agreed beforehand that this will be more of a conversation than an interview. All right, Merle, let me ask you this. I checked over your previous interviews, and in a 1973 interview, you spoke about the need to update peace movement research. That was in 1973. And I'm just wondering if you have been able to keep up with the peace research, and what do you think of it now?
Yeah. Pretty much. There's been a great deal of it. I've just read a new monograph by Valerie Ziegler, her dissertation at Emory University, on exactly the same subject that I wrote on 63 years ago.
My goodness.
She has no new sources at all, but her method is one of great intensive analysis. And this seems to me to mark one of the great changes in historical scholarship since I began. Much more interest in analysis. I see here reflections of linguistic studies, philosophy, logic, and so on. And I was very pleased to read this monograph. It analyzes the limits of violence and nonviolence in a very precise way. And with pleasure, I wrote and commended her on her contributions.
Oh, she must have been thrilled.
And she's written a very nice response in which she says that she regards my book as basic and so forth and so on. So it seems to me that there has been a continuing interest. We have a journal, Peace and Change, well edited, quarterly, with efforts made to see relationships between issues of war, violence, nonviolence, and current problems in terms of race, ethnicity, and so on.
Pause for a moment, okay? I find this very interesting that somebody would take up the same subject as you did 63 years ago. What was that subject?
It's called the American Peace Crusade.
Uh-huh. And it's a historic survey.
An outgrowth of my dissertation.
Uh-huh. Now, do you think that other topics on other areas of study have emerged in this interim since you wrote about it in this field?
Yes. I tried to show that the American peace movement had to be understood in terms of European protests against war. And this has now been carried to a much greater degree than even I had hoped. They have think of her name, who's written some splendid monographs on peace movements in Europe. She's recently written a new life of Mrs. Roosevelt.
Oh, Blanche Weisen Cook.
She's done some very good things on European peace movements.
I see.
And I had hoped that this would sometime be done, and now I see it being done.
I see. So you feel this particular field has progressed in a way that feels satisfactory to you?
Yes. It seems to me I'm very pleased to see the interest of so many in it and writing as they are.
Uh-huh. That's very good. And you also think then that the more complex methodology is something that has improved.
Yes. I think that in my day there was much less analysis of texts than there has come to be, and I'm very glad to see this.
Uh-huh.
I think it's important to see the assumptions that the writers of the text seem to have made, and to probe the interrelationships and the validity of one statement in relation to another statement in the text. So I'm very happy to see the analysis.
Well, that's very good to hear. Now, the same way, I'm going to ask you the same question in regard to intellectual history, which is a field that you virtually were the main exponent of and a founder of the field. And have there been new developments, and what do you think of them in intellectual history?
The problem when I started was one of distinguishing between the history of ideas as such and the place of ideas in our culture and in our thought.
What do you mean by that? Can you elaborate a little?
Yes. Professor Lovejoy at Johns Hopkins,
yes,
professor of philosophy, was the great exponent and a very vigorous and able one of the history of ideas in an abstract sense, the relation of one idea to another over time, but without any reference to context. And it seemed to me that ideas...
No social context. I see.
No real cultural context.
I see.
It's an abstraction of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that ideas needed to be understood in relationship to the culture, social structure.
Well, that was the great merit of your work.
Yeah, that was. And this is the emphasis that I made. But I said in the preface to The Growth of American Thought that I hoped historians would bring together these two points of view, these two ways of doing things. And I think this has been, it's happened. I think we have much more putting together of abstract analysis of ideas and of their role in society and the influence of society on them.
And do you notice that people pursue the same concept, or has the field been conceptualized differently?
Much more. We were interested in such traditional ideas as the idea of progress.
Right.
Now I think the work reflects new social issues. Much more on the role of gender, race, and
do you think that that's more,
and technology?
Technology too.
Yes. The whole idea of modernity, which I hear about, has been very nicely exemplified in a book I've just finished reading by William R. Taylor called Commerce and Culture in New York City. It's very good because he shows the interrelationship between technology, mass culture, the elite, popular culture.
Yeah, isn't there more emphasis now, too, on distinguishing the elite culture
right.
from the popular
right.
culture?
And there's been a great development in this, as you know, in the study of popular culture.
Right. Wasn't in existence at the time.
Well, not really. I tried to do a little with it and pointed out the need for people to do something with it. But what we had chiefly was folklore studies
yeah.
of folklore. And
well,
we haven't got much beyond folklore.
Uh-huh.
I
think that maybe this is an outgrowth of American studies.
I think it's very much related to American studies, that the American studies people saw the importance of mass culture and what we call middlebrow culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this has been one of their many contributions.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. So you say that new ideas are being studied, and they're being studied in a more sophisticated way, would you say? Or?
And we can also point to some efforts in intellectual history to use quantification. A good example of that is Carl Kaisel's History of Literacy in the United States. And he's concerned with who read books.
Yeah.
And here he's done quite a good deal of quantification. And it tells us something about the readership of books.
Well, that brings me to an interesting thought. I mean, at the time that you did your major work, the social history that came out of the Annales school was really not yet in existence,
right? Right.
And so the whole basis, the technical basis for dealing with larger groups of anonymous people didn't really exist yet.
Right.
And do you think that has had an impact on intellectual history?
Yes, I'm sure it has.
Uh-huh. Like in Kaisel's book.
Like in Kaisel's book. Where groups of readers, in terms of age,
uh-huh.
gender, occupation,
right.
Background, parental background, what do they read? What changes does
exactly.
one see in reading interest?
In reading interest, and we also, I think the earlier studies of literacy, for example, only dealt with signing.
That's right.
Which doesn't tell us. We find out now that people may have been able to sign only, but be very literate in terms of reading,
right.
but couldn't write.
Right.
Writing came after reading.
Right.
So that this new method, I think, is much more accurate. We're getting a much more broad-based and accurate picture.
I agree.
Yeah. What about the so to speak, the conceptual framework for intellectual history, which in America, I mean, with Parenton and Curdy, I would say, was, after all, and with the New England School, was based on religion and a sort of a constitutional liberalism?
Yes.
Okay. Has anything changed in that direction in the past 40, 50 years?
Yes, I think that there has been a response to the great movements of thought, Freud and psychoanalysis, the physicist's conception of indeterminacy, and Marx with class, and all of those who were concerned with gender. I think all of these things have come into intellectual history.
And also perhaps a kind of a pessimism?
And a kind of a pessimism. One can, I think Randall Niebuhr is an example of this. I think he had a great deal of influence on many of the younger intellectual historians in making them skeptical about the old optimistic ideas of progress and Millerism, and brought in probably a sense of realism, which was needed and refreshing.
Well, I think that's fascinating because so you think it came by way of certain intellectuals like Freud and Niebuhr and so on. What about the actual experience since World War II? Fascism, the Holocaust, the nuclear age, Hiroshima. Has that, do you think, affected intellectual history?
Definitely. Definitely. I responded to it in a small way with the different prefaces to The Growth of American Thought, indicating that if I were to write the book now, wherein it would be different. And all of them are related to what we might call evidences of failures to achieve our more optimistic goals.
Okay. So this question of the failure, the 20th century, you know, experience, I would call it, people call that modernism, this 20th century experience of the limits of progress, of perhaps the pitfalls of progress, right? That's very prevalent now in all of the cultural product. And it's something that is being criticized a great deal.
And in the sense that we may have gone too far.
That maybe we're losing the core of what is necessary to build a positive world.
I'd like to think that were true.
You do like to think
like
that.
To think
so you have basically stayed optimistic, I take it.
I've tried to.
Yeah. How have you done? I mean, when you say I've tried to, that's sort of recognizing, you're saying that with a very nice little smile. Which indicates you don't really think you've quite succeeded, huh?
Well, we can't erase all of these things that have happened.
Right.
And if they've happened once, have we learned enough from the history of them to avoid them in the future? I'm not sure. I see the violence of ethnicity in Yugoslavia today.
It seems
to me we should have learned. Right. That ethic problem can't really be resolved by violence.
That's true. And what's striking about them, isn't it, is that almost to the, not only just the very location, this is replaying World War One.
Yes.
Not World War Two.
Right.
World War One. We're going back 80 years or something, you know.
Good point.
And that's very, it's very disturbing. My question is whether, you see, right now we're being attacked from conservatives and right-wing people because of this skepticism, because of this lack of what they like to call traditional values. And yet it seems to me almost impossible that we should have the same intellectual history as people who didn't go through the 20th century experience.
I think that's very well taken.
I mean, after all, it happened. But, you know, we can't deny that all these things happened.
Well, so they're possible, if not probable. But you mentioned a few minutes ago religion, and I would like to point out a revival of interest in scholarship in this country in religion.
Uh-huh.
And I think of that perhaps as a response in general to the dilemma of pessimism and optimism.
Well, that's very interesting. I think that you are onto something very important there.
Well, take these fundamentalists. In a world of great indeterminacy, they reject all indeterminacy. Everything is for certain. And it seems to me that I was thinking of Martin Marty's work and his new projected six-volume history of American religion. This would have been unlikely at an earlier 50 years ago.
Why?
I think there was a feeling that secularization had triumphed now in America.
I see.
And
yes,
that religion was peripheral. Now it seems to me that the tremendous growth of fundamentalism.
Well, but you know, I don't equate the history of religion necessarily with the history of fundamentalism.
No.
I think fundamentalism is one tendency in religion, but I think there's another tendency in religious studies that is very encouraging, and that is a kind of a different recognition of the significance of religion as a social force. Religion as a way of expressing popular culture and of even allowing for an intellectual expression for non-intellectuals.
Yeah. You would differentiate this from the old social gospel.
Yes, I do. Because the social gospel was essentially an elite religion applied to the underclass.
Yeah.
What we're now studying is how religion expresses, you know, profound belief system of people who don't know they have a philosophy,
right,
necessarily. Right. And there's a kind of a social dimension to religious history that has come in now that I think is something new. And a very hopeful one.
And very good.
Yes, in many ways, very good.
That
and
is a shift from an emphasis on the institutional and theological aspect.
That's it. There's a shift from the institutional to the actually perhaps institutional at the grassroots level. We're not studying the church, but we're studying people who are believers.
Who've experienced it.
Yeah,
experience.
People who've experienced revivals, people who have, you know, what did the revivals do to people, and so on. Yeah, that, I think that's, of course, that is directly a result of the social history.
I think so.
You know, again, here we see
where?
What I'm noticing as we're talking, I hadn't thought about that before, is that, well, when would you say that the new social history began to be firmly established in America?
I've thought about that question, and I don't know. There were aspects of it in the early part of this century, but it's always seemed to me that the elder Schlesinger had a good deal to do with establishing social history.
Well, what about this SSRC project in the 30s or 40s?
Yeah.
You were part of that.
I was part of that.
When was that? Was it in the 40s?
It was in the late 30s and 40s.
Okay.
And
seems to me that established it.
Well, I'd like to think so,
no?
But I'm not sure. I think it contributed to this, but I think so many other things were happening at the same time.
No, I think that, I mean, this was the period just prior, maybe 5 years later, I entered academic studies, and it was very much the new thing when I studied, you see. And I think that it was this SSRC project and a number of authors writing around it and in it, in this mode, that then established a new social history as an exciting new tool. And so it seems to me from the 50s forward, that began then to affect the methodologies of other historical fields in a way that was not foreseen. In other words, we've just now talked about how it affected intellectual history, right?
And religious history.
And religious history. Nobody could foresee that. Nobody had that in mind. They just thought they were going to be scientific. You know, we are now no longer so sure that we're that scientific with it, but we have learned that it's very useful to address problems that that previously we addressed without their context.
Good.
As you said.
Yeah. I like that. Also, it seems to me that the interdisciplinary movement, which in the humanistic studies was represented by the American Studies movement, but in social history, there was a great deal of influence of cultural anthropology, social psychology, and other social sciences.
And you think that's been to the good?
And I think that's been to the good. I think that things are interrelated, and I think the interdisciplinary things help bring out interrelationships. And I think it was very important in the development. I think historians and other scholars were probably unconsciously reflecting the interdisciplinary achievements in the natural sciences, biophysics.
That's an interesting thought.
And I think unconsciously,
we saw
the value of cross disciplines.
That's fascinating. I never heard that said.
I think
that's very possible.
All of us who were concerned with Bulletin 54 were reflecting this. I'm always wondering from what you said, who are the agents in social change and social history? The people who've experienced religion, we don't know their names in general, but they're the ones who have experienced something. And are we to think of them as agents in this new religious sense?
I think the two come together, and you have it's interesting. We started out talking about intellectual history and the history of ideas and abstractions, right? And we keep coming back to social history as an agent or a method that began to that did two things. It gave us a broader base of information, right? At the time you wrote your intellectual history, you had no way of knowing what unlettered, illiterate people's intellectual life was like. You had no method that could tell you that, except perhaps art or folklore, but you couldn't study it in any scientific way. So that was opened up by social history. But at the same time, also social history made us think of other questions that couldn't be answered with historical method alone. And so the influence of literature through American studies, biographies, letters, all those new sources that hadn't been used so much before, I think maybe that is the way it happened.
I think I agree. But I've been interested in this use on the part of some historians in the word agent. This is something that was unfamiliar to me when I began to read this.
Why? Didn't you think that people were agents when you were writing?
Well, I thought of intellectual leaders.
Ah.
Leaders.
I see what you mean.
I thought of movements, leaders in new movements of thought. But now in social history, I'm not sure. It seems to me the surge, the impetus comes from the mass, from the groups, rather than any leaders.
This is very obvious when you study the history of the left wing of the Protestant Reformation, and you see the immense intellectual ferment among sectarians and how that leads to major movements for change. And it's clearly, it starts with a religious idea, but it becomes something else. It becomes all kinds of social activism and the evangelicals in America.
Right. And of course, with these TV and radio evangelists, we see the influence of modern technology.
That hasn't been studied much, has it?
Not too much, at least within my knowledge.
I think those are very interesting ideas. I was going to ask you whether in intellectual history you have any people that you think have done particularly important work since the time that you were active in the field.
Oh, I think so many have.
Yeah?
I'm trying to think of the name of the woman who wrote on women in the, as social scientists.
Oh, I know. I see what you mean.
She gave me a copy of her book, but now I can't remember.
Margaret Rossiter?
No, not Rossiter.
No?
She was in natural science, in social science.
Social
women
science.
Women in social science.
Right.
I think this is very good because...
Rosenberg, Rosalind Rosenberg.
Rosenberg.
Yeah.
It made us see what we'd been completely blind to, how much these women brought to social science. It wasn't that they were just doing the same thing. They brought new ideas
new
into it.
Evelyn Fox Keller writes about that too.
Yes.
Yes. That's very interesting. Now, let me ask you the same sort of question to the field of community studies, which also was a field that you pioneered in with the Trempealeau County study, and that has expanded in directions that I don't know how you feel about these new directions.
Well, I've been very glad to see some of the work that I've been able to follow. It seems to me that in a world of bigness, where so many things are measured by bigness, the community studies got down to much closer to real groups interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think historians are able to do something in these more microscopic community studies that they aren't able to do on the large mass scale. On the other hand, I would hate to see specialists in any field get to the point where we had no generalists, where we had no one really interested in more than a highly specialized thing, such as a community study or any other.
But of course, some community studies are actually models in which you look at a very detailed place in a detailed way, but you are really making points that apply for a much larger scale. For example, Tom Dublin's work on the Lowell Mill Girls tells you something about modernization in general, not just applicable to New England.
That's right.
There too, we see a lot of influence of the new social history, don't we, in community studies. Quantification.
I haven't been able to keep up in any field of history as I would like to, but I'm sure there must be some studies that I have missed on black communities.
Black communities?
Yes, small black communities.
Yes, there are. There's a study on Washington, D.C. There are some very good study of black Chicago, Alan Speer. There are a number.
Yeah.
Not as many, but there are a number, and there are more now.
I must try to brush up and read some of them.
But I think there the biggest change has been quantification and the ability to extract from census data and through what they call family reconstruction, a kind of institutional underpinning that wasn't possible to do when you were doing Trempealeau County. You couldn't do it. There was no methodology available. So that field has gotten technically very much more complicated, but also probably richer. Well, I wanted to ask you also whether you have at all been able to keep up with the developments in African American studies.
Not really.
No?
I wish that I could say that I had been.
Do you read any biographies in that field?
I've read a recent biography of
The King, or of
King, and it's dreadful to lose your memory. I can't.
That's okay. You're doing great.
I can't. But I have read some.
But you haven't really kept up with the field as a whole. Well, it's not possible to keep up with everything.
I've wondered, however, whether necessary though the specialization is, whether we can separate blacks, to the extent that historians do, from all the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's...
Hasn't there been a great deal of interaction between the two?
Well, I think the best of the studies are always aware of that interaction. Like Nell Painter's study of the exodusters, the people that left for Nebraska and for Oklahoma after the Civil War, the blacks, in response to white violence. I mean, that's a story that is constantly talking about the white world and the black world in interaction, although it focuses on the black. You know, that's a little bit like the problem of women's history. You can't study women as though the world of men didn't exist, but yet you must study women from a point of view that focuses on them. And I think that's what happened in African American too. You focus on the black history, but you tell it, of course, in a context of a whole society. Now, I don't know how much you have kept up, and I'm sure you have because you read all the journals, with this new right-wing attack on academics, which they call PC, with a charge like Harold Bloom and others that...
I read Bloom's book.
Yeah, that the fields are all fragmented. Hammerow's charge that history is practically going down the drain, that there are no longer any common values and purposes, and that these specializations in many different fields has been a real danger to the whole fabric of society.
I think that's an extreme position. I have some sympathy with it. But stated in this way, it's a very extreme position. I don't think any intellectual or academic movement can have as much influence on all of society as Hammerow seems to think it can. He seems to see a danger that I don't see.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that the whole fabric of society is so complicated. This could be only one possibly contributing factor to one way or another, but it doesn't have the autonomy,
okay.
Seems to me. So my feeling about all this is talk show people and writers in the Atlantic Monthly and other journals have greatly exaggerated the danger of the emphasis on giving recognition to these various minority groups. It seems to me that academic life goes on not too differently, and I don't
uh-huh.
see any imminent danger that scholars in history are going to overall lose some concern with the great intellectual traditions of the ancient Mediterranean and of Europe.
Okay, you don't see any current danger. That's exaggerated.
I may be wrong because
I want to hear what you think. But I am more concerned now with the charge that the fragmentation of historical studies into subdivisions like African American, Hispanic American, Native American studies, women's history, different social histories, all right? That if we do all those specializations, that we are losing a common language, we're no longer really studying society as a whole.
Well, because these things have been neglected, it's important and probably indispensable to put more emphasis on them than would have been the case had there been a stream of interest in these all the way along.
Right.
It seems
right.
to me in any protest movement, you, in order to be heard, you have to take an extreme position or you won't be listened to. That's been true in all social
mm-hmm.
protest movements
mm-hmm.
that I know anything about.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me for the time being, this is the only way probably all of these fields of interest could get heard and work could be done in them. But I would like to think that they will, that this is a means toward an end of incorporating all of these things into the whole stream of our consciousness about our past.
Mm-hmm. Well, one could, of course, take the position that what we know as the classical tradition has actually been nothing but a sliver of a small percentage of experience and history that we have studied as though it were the whole. We have always neglected the history of half the human race, women, and most of the so-called minorities. So if you add them all together, we have only told the history of elites for most of the time. So one could take the position that the whole concept that what we used to do is the true history, to which we all should return, is really an erroneous concept.
In a way, yes. On the other hand, it seems to me that the great scientists and the great writers and philosophers had something to contribute.
Oh, yeah.
That we shouldn't lose.
Oh, that's true.
And they couldn't have done it independently of their surroundings. So to that extent, it seems to me, it will always be important to know something about the history that made possible these great human achievements.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that in fact, my own position is that these new fields will eventually enable us to tell the story of the great achievements of Western civilization in a much richer and fuller way than we have ever been able to tell them. I see no danger that we're going to not study Homer or Shakespeare or Mozart or anything like that. But I think that we have a long ways to go to understand really what the achievement of these individuals meant, because all we have done is looked at the end result. We haven't looked at
the social cost of it all.
The social cost, the contributing people that were never mentioned, you know, the famous woman behind the man.
As it's been written and taught, there has been a kind of an exclusive eliteness about all of this.
That's right.
I wouldn't want to see it thrown out, but I certainly want, I'm very glad to see.
Uh-huh.
Emphases on these long neglected groups of human beings.
Well, that's good to hear. I think it's remarkable that at your age you have a much more open mind than many people much younger than yourself, who seem to be essentially stuck with whatever it was they learned in graduate school. I mean, I must say, I have now been in as a historian for 30 or 35 years. And I find I have to constantly learn in order to, and you are constantly learning, obviously.
Well, I've been very much interested in what I see to have happened
in
historical scholarship.
And you've been open to it.
And it seems to me there's been a great deal of vigor and a great deal of freshness that we lacked as I look back on the graduate work that I did. 70 years ago, it was solid and good in many ways, but it was very restricted and very limited, and it was unopened to any of the other disciplines. History was, except in a small way, maybe politics, but otherwise it was a very narrow domain. So
uh-huh.
I've been very glad to see what's happened. I think it's given substance and method. What we're all should be concerned about.
Well, I think this is very, very encouraging to hear you say that, because there's a kind of an assumption now that the older people have to become conservative, and I don't share that, and you don't share that, and I think that's wonderful to see that. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with some of the discussion around the topic of multiculturalism.
Some of it.
Yeah. Well, I attended a very interesting discussion last spring on the West Coast by teachers who are all in women's history, but who are trying to teach women's history now from a multicultural point of view. And the discussion, first of all, they know things that I have never heard, which is very interesting. I mean, they know about Indian, Native American, Indian cultures. They know about Hispanics of different types and how they affected the settlement of the West. Things that I never was taught, never heard about. But the debate was whether multiculturalism is the right way of conceptualizing American culture, or whether American culture is really a two-racial culture in which the other race is always black and all the other cultures, the other minorities, fall under that rubric.
That's the way that the dominant people have had it. That's the way it's been made out to us.
That's the way it's been made out, yeah. Right.
But I don't think that that is true.
Uh-huh.
I think there's much more to it than that.
You think the multicultural model is more likely to be
I think
truer.
We should explore it.
Uh-huh.
And see what it will yield.
Now, for example, these people are teaching colonial history, starting with the conquest of Mexico. They start with the Mexican culture, and they talk about the university in Mexico City in the 16th century, and then they talk about the settlement,
yeah.
I mean, the Hispanic settlement of America. So by the time you get to the Pilgrims, you've already had 200, 300 years
yeah.
of history. It's very interesting what happens when you do that.
Yes. Well, I think we have to take it.
It affects periodization, you know. It affects what are your main events. It's very challenging. Now, on the other hand, I feel there's a certain validity in studying the problem of race. See, the interesting thing is that no other race in America has been treated as has the black race. You know, you can make a case that we have had a fairly genocidal policy toward the Native Americans, but yet we haven't ever carried it through, you know? And so the black-white model is very strong in our intellectual history. I'm not so sure that it's accurate. See, that would be an interesting example of where the conceptual framework is very different from the way
the actuality.
Yeah, from the way the society actually functions. And the only way we can study how the society actually functions is to become aware of the conceptual model under which it operates, which is a black-white model.
Yeah. I'm glad you said the black-white model, because it seems to me we need to know much more about the blacks, and the blacks need to know much more about themselves. But I'm skeptical of the claim that that would enable blacks to have more self-esteem.
Why are you skeptical of that?
I think that many blacks, if the movies I see are all representative of the black ghetto, would brush it all off and say, "And so what?" I think they would be very skeptical and very negative.
Well,
I'm not sure that the universities can do what they would like to do in their efforts to recruit Native Americans. I think some of the 119 who are here, with three administrators giving their complete time to them, may be quite unhappy and wish they were somewhere else.
Between Merle Curdy and Gerda Lerner, side two. Merle, we've been talking about different aspects of historical studies and their development. Now, we have not really talked about the field that I'm most interested in, women's history, and whether what your thoughts are about it, and whether you've read anything that's been of value to you, and so on.
Yes, I like to think of myself as one of the male predecessors
right.
of the whole movement.
Well, you are.
And I've been immensely impressed by what you and others have done in developing this field. As I read reviews of monographs, I wonder what next. It seems to me that people who've been directing these have a good deal of imagination. Some of them seem on the border of trivializing subjects.
Oh, yeah?
I haven't read the monographs. I've just read reviews of them.
I see.
But I have great confidence in the expanding role of this. I don't think it's. I think there are all kinds of things that
have you
that are, you can yet do that can yet be done.
Have you read Suzanne Lebsack's book, The Women of St. Petersburg?
No.
No.
I should read that.
The Women of Petersburg, Virginia, not St. Petersburg. Petersburg, Virginia.
I read reviews of it.
Yeah. And there's a wonderful new book which won all kinds of awards, the Pulitzer among them, the Bancroft, by Martha Ballard, called The Midwife's Tale.
Yes.
And she's just gotten a MacArthur. Yeah. So that book is extraordinary. She takes a
I'll read it.
A diary of a colonial midwife, and it's a very sparse diary, the likes of which you've seen and I've seen a dozen of times. And she expands it by wonderful research so that she tells you about the whole community and the whole structure of society. It's really quite a wonderful book, The Midwife's Tale. I was wondering if you had any other comment on the state of history and the historical studies since you have left the profession, since you've retired.
No, I haven't been able to go to many meetings of either any of the societies. And I've had the feeling that there is something to be said for the old informal intimacy when the profession was much smaller. On the other hand, I used to chafe at its smugness. So you can't have everything, but I think it's wonderful to for the societies and the meetings to represent young people. In the earlier times, you very seldom heard papers from young people.
That's true.
They all had to be established.
Uh-huh.
And so I like the idea of the inclusiveness and the vigor that I think young people bring to any organization. So the few times I've gone, as I say, I've missed the sense of intimacy.
Okay. All right, let me shift ground a little bit. I'd like to talk a little bit about your graduate students. How many graduate students have you had? I'm talking about the ones that you directed, the PhD. Do you know? Have you ever counted?
No. I think I'd counted once, and it was something around 80 or 90.
Oh, that is fabulous. 80 or 90, okay. And do you think there's a Curdy School of history?
Oh, no.
Did
no,
you ever want it?
And I'm very glad there isn't.
Why?
I think that, I think everyone should work out a way of looking at history and doing history on his or her own. And I like to think of one of my students who had written on the women's suffrage movement in Wisconsin for his dissertation. He got a job at the University of Oklahoma, and very sensibly and on his own, he studied ethnology, anthropology, and began working on Indian Native American history. He's had four books and is one of the leaders in his field in Native American history. So I think that's a good example of my pleasure in students who've shifted ground when the sources, when new sources were available and people.
Well, maybe the Curdy School is to have students who are able to adapt and to be creative. Is that could that be what you taught them?
I occasionally got a manuscript from one of my former students.
Right.
Wanted me to comment on it. I've just had one from an unreconstructed Marxist.
Oh, really?
He writes and says he has a new theory of history. It's a kind of a revised Marxism, as far as I can see. But it's interesting, and he's written several essays to substantiate this. And he sent them to me for comment, and I've written three pages.
Huh. So you still stay quite close to students? How many would you think that you sort of, in the course of a year, that you hear from?
Perhaps not more than 10 or so.
Well, that's...
Then I get Christmas cards from a good many, sometimes with a note.
But 10 or so send you their work and ask for comments.
Yeah.
Well, that's marvelous, you know.
Yeah.
That's quite amazing. Are there any of your students that you think have, in a particular way, carried on the work that you had, that you were interested in?
Well, I was very much interested in historiography, and John Higham, of course, has done a great deal.
Well, he was your student. Well, you could be proud of him, I should say. And how about in intellectual history? Well, he is an intellectual.
He's really an intellectual.
Yes.
One of my very best women students is now president of Rockford College.
And who's that?
She did a dissertation on American ideas of genius. And it was very nice. She got an article out of it. But she turned to help her husband, I think, who was also in the profession. This is...
Well, forget it. That's okay. So you have a few that did continue along the lines that you pursued, but you...
I've had several who wrote on aspects of black history.
Oh, I see. How about the community studies part? Did anybody carry that
on?
No
one carried that on. People from other places.
But I remember at the celebration, I think, of your 90th birthday, that there were some people that carried on the community studies.
Yes, there were some. I can't quite think who they are. But I've had several who've been interested in immigration history. Among others, Rudy Vicoli, who's done a marvelous job in developing an archive.
Who's that?
Vicoli at the University
of
Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, Rudy Vicoli. Yeah, I know him.
And several others who've done studies in immigration and ethnic history.
Now, can you say what achievement in your own life you're most pleased with?
I don't quite get the
What
question.
Achievement in your own life as a writer and a historian and a teacher, what has meant the most to you?
Oh, I think it was simply the pleasure of the students that I've had, of knowing them and feeling a sense of comradeship with them.
So the teaching to you was always...
Teaching has been, to me, the most pleasurable.
That's interesting. You define yourself more as a teacher than as a writer.
I think so.
With all your impressive written work, that's really very interesting. Would you say you've had any main disappointment in your professional life?
Yes.
Yes?
I would like to have had everything much better than it actually was in terms of writing.
Your writing?
My writing.
You would have liked to be a better writer?
I'd like to have been a better historian.
Oh.
You're also a better writer. One of the interesting things I've noticed in such monographs as I've read is an improvement in writing. And I attribute this to several influences. One, perhaps, to the American studies people, who included people from literature who ought to write better. And then I think that Samuel Eliot Morison set a very high standard for writing and encouraged a great many young people to try to write better. And it seems to me that writing, in general, is considerably better than it was.
And you feel you weren't equipped as a writer the same way as they are?
Yeah.
I think that's a very subjective judgment that a lot of your readers would not agree with, but there it is. In terms of your own career, for example, were you ever president of one of the historical societies?
Of the American Historical Society, the old Mississippi Valley.
Okay, so you had both of those honors.
And the American Historical Society.
Did they mean anything to you?
Yes, at the time they did. It's very interesting. It's something like a Phi Beta Kappa. I thought as an undergraduate how much it would mean to me to make Phi Beta Kappa. I knew I wanted to be a teacher and that this would be helpful. Well, I made Phi Beta Kappa and it seemed utterly unimportant.
Right.
So the same thing is true about whatever I've done.
Well,
at the time it seemed very important.
That's very interesting.
In retrospect, it seems relatively unimportant.
Interesting. A lot of the things we think are very important at the time, when we get them, they're not that important.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Was there ever any particular honor bestowed on you or distinction given to you that you could say, you know, that really felt very good to me?
Well, there was an honor from the American Council of Learned Societies. I forgot just what it was, but it was a very fine appreciation and a very substantial financial award. And it was in recognition of scholarly
achievement. So maybe they thought you were a pretty good writer.
Perhaps.
All right. Now, if I were to ask you, maybe this goes back very far, but who fostered your intellectual growth? Who was the influence, the person or persons or institutions that helped you most in your development?
Well, I had a high school teacher of history.
Everybody says that. It's wonderful.
And she was a first-rate teacher.
Uh-huh.
And she got me interested in history and encouraged my interest. And looking back on her, probably she was an old-fashioned traditional historian. In some ways she wasn't, because she taught us history from the sources.
Uh-huh.
And she left to become married. I lost touch with her. But a great many years later, I was invited to have an honorary degree at the University of Nebraska. And the marshal said, there's a little old lady who says she's come by bus all the way from Omaha to Lincoln, and she would like to speak to you. He said, we'll hold up the procession, but don't talk too long. And so this charming little lady said, you may remember me as Judith Bednar. I said, Miss Bednar, how could I ever forget you? And my apologies for not having kept in touch with you. But you know, you did marry and leave Omaha.
That's wonderful.
She said, I've kept up my interest in history ever since. I'm a mother, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother. And I've been on curricular committees, and I've always plugged for history.
Oh, that's wonderful. So it was a teacher.
So I was a teacher.
And who was your main support over the years?
Well, I think Turner was intellectually a great influence, not because of the frontier theory,
no,
but because his conception of history as process, mm-hmm, and because of his sense that history is movement, and populations are concerned in it.
Well, in a way, he was really, it seems to me, his concepts were way ahead of his time in terms of social history.
Yes.
He really understood that people are agents in history,
right,
and he and at a time when nobody had that idea, so he was a very advanced thinker.
And he was really the father of environmental history.
That's interesting. Uh-huh.
And, he was a great teacher of graduate students, and because he involved each of us in what we were, what the others were doing.
But in your...
What he was doing.
Uh-huh. In your own pursuit of that, you know, of your historical studies, he was an inspiration. But who supported you? Did you have a friend? Did your wives or your mother or your family or, you know,
yeah,
what's...
Well,
what was your support network?
Yeah. Well, my sister did a good
sister
deal to help me through graduate school.
Uh-huh.
Financially. And my
she helped you financially?
Yes. And my first wife was of enormous help to me. In fact, I can't overemphasize how much she did. She herself was a scholar and a psychologist, and it was she who said in the 1920s that historians had better discover the role of women in history.
She influenced you in that direction,
huh? I was still pretty traditional, because I said, we don't have the documents. I was thinking of political history.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I'm sure there are documents if you really look for them. But she was a good scholar,
uh-huh,
herself, a meticulous, logical thinker, and she did a great deal for whatever manuscript I wrote in the way of asking sharp questions about it and getting me to think more about it. So my debt was very great to her.
Well, that's great. That's great. If you have
and
somebody...
And of course, Charles and Mary Beard were great influences.
Well, they're really great influences.
Yeah.
I never heard you speak about them.
Well,
in what way? When did you know them?
I knew them. I'm trying to think how I got acquainted with them. I was their guest more than one weekend at New Bedford. And he read...
Did you know them when you were at Vassar?
No, at Smith. No,
at Smith?
Yes, I did. That was when I got acquainted with him. We invited Charles Beard to give a lecture.
Uh-huh.
And
well, it was the one where Mary came and she
and
wasn't
Mary came
invited.
And we didn't. We hadn't thought of asking.
Terrible.
Her.
Yeah.
So, but she later became a real influence on me.
Is that right?
Yes.
Was she a friendly person, an outgoing person?
Well, she was. Yes and no. She was very sensitive.
Uh-huh.
And I think some of us didn't realize how sensitive she was. For example, I was chair of the program committee in 1940, the AHA, and I wanted to have a session on women's history. And we found it very hard to get people to read papers. And we asked her to preside over the session. We thought that was the chief honor, but her feelings were very hurt. She wanted to be asked to give a paper, but somehow we thought that she's written her book, and we ought to honor her by having her preside.
And she didn't? Never came off?
She refused.
Huh. That's predictable.
Right.
That's interesting. And she
stayed. Both of them had a great influence on me.
But she stayed friendly.
Oh yes.
To you.
Yes.
Do you understand at all the puzzlement that Nancy Carter and I have talked endlessly about, how these two people, both historians, could manage to destroy their own papers?
It's very hard for me to imagine it. But when I think of Beard's unwillingness to respond to the question just what part he and what part Mary had in the rise of civilization, he would never make any clear statement. He would say it was joint work and her contributions were equal to mine, if not superior.
Hmm.
And I think he felt that in the one volume, The American Mind, she had been the chief contributor as far as ideas.
Yeah, a lot of people think that it was her book, the concepts of her,
and
anything
I think Charles,
else, and he didn't.
He intimated that.
He didn't do it. Yeah, that's too bad. Uh-huh, that's very interesting. Well, let's switch topics again. You have now reached a ripe old age, what they call old old, right? And I know that in spirit and mind, you're one of the youngest people I know. But yet you are living through old age in a very conscious way, and I thought it would be good to talk about that a little bit. First of all, is the experience what you expected?
No.
What did you expect?
I expected that things would be pretty much the same.
Uh-huh.
I didn't realize physiologically the decline that age always has to involve.
Uh-huh. You did not expect
that. I counted on doing much more reading and work in my older years than was possible.
Uh-huh.
It was unrealistic.
Nobody prepares you for it, right?
No. It was unrealistic. You could look around in nature and see that that's not the way it is. But
right.
Somehow I didn't do that. So I've been disappointed in not having anything that seems to be much more than just surviving and enjoying friends.
That's not what you look like to other people. Other people always marvel at your intellectual productivity and alertness and interest in everything and your judgments and so on. You don't seem to appreciate that people see you that way.
Well, if they do, it's because of the people.
I don't think so. I think it's because of you.
If I have any best, it's with them in response to them.
Well, the thing is, a certain decline, one could almost, seems to me,
predict
that unless there were a decline, nobody would ever die.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, isn't that so?
Of course.
We need to decline somewhat in order to give up at some point, no?
Yes, but I've always thought how much better it would have been if we could have zipped off when our energies really began to fail.
Ah, yeah. I guess a lot of, I think that's part of the experience. I would agree with you. Well, would you say that you now feel more distant in a certain way to events, to politics, to academic politics,
yes,
that you have a different perspective?
Yes.
And can you describe that a little bit?
I think I took academic politics too seriously.
Uh-huh.
They seemed very important at the time. An appointment here or something there. And it really wouldn't have made much difference one way or the other.
And how
and
about...
I think a lot of energy is spent on academic politics.
Right.
Which should be better put to other uses. I don't mean to say I was any great academic politician, but I wanted.
What about?
I wanted to be. I guess I just wanted to be counted, and wanting to be counted probably expected more and demanded more than.
And you probably were ambitious, in a certain way, right? And that now, when you're retired, there's nothing
there's
more
nothing to be ambitious about.
Yeah, but is that a loss or is that a gain?
Oh, in a way it's a gain.
Okay, I want to know how it is a gain.
I think it's a gain.
Yeah.
Because there's no stress.
No stress.
No anxiety.
That's true. Much less anxiety.
And an acceptance and a kind of a peace.
Okay. How about then the involvement in politics and social issues? That's also less.
I'm still
less,
interested
huh?
in
But you're still interested.
I'm still interested, but not to the same extent that I was during most of my active life.
You've always been very active in social affairs, right?
Well, I've always been very much interested in the way things shape up.
But you've also always been an agent, too. You haven't just let things happen. I remember you told me about how you fought for against discrimination.
And my wife and I fought against McCarthyism.
All right, so you were involved. No. Now you're no longer involved in that way. No. Does that seem like a loss to you, or does that seem like it's okay?
Well, both. It's a loss because even though you realize that what you did wasn't very important, it was the sense that you were trying to do something that was rewarding. In retrospect, while I don't think what we did individually counted for much, collectively, what people like us did count for something. And so it's in a sense a loss that you're not contributing to the things that are needed now.
Okay, but that's, I think, to be able to look back on your own life and feel that you did contribute in the right way is certainly a good thing. Not everybody can say that. A lot of people are not at peace with their life.
No, I wish I had done more, but I'm very glad I did whatever I did do.
Okay. Well, I was wondering if there are any gains to old age.
There must be, because there must be gains to everything. There must be some way.
Why? Wait a minute. That's interesting. Why must there be gains to everything? Is there a benign providence that provides that?
No, there's not a benign, but there are always different ways of looking at the same thing.
Okay.
And I try to look at things past and present as a probably the outcome is as good as one logically and rationally to expect.
Well,
so
okay, now let me ask you this way. I mean, your detachment and peace go together. More balance, less stress, you already said, right? Is there anything about the long-range perspective that feels good to you?
Yes, in some ways.
Okay, I'd like to hear about that.
It seems to me that there are fashions in politics, as in other things, there are ups and downs, gains and losses, and we should not be too discouraged by losses at the present time. We should have faith that it's possible, if not probable, that things will swing in a different direction. If there are collective efforts, and if there's leadership.
So you have a long-range historical perspective. I was going to ask you whether, having been a historian most of your active life and a very long life, whether that equips you better to deal with old age.
I believe so.
Okay, how? Can you tell people? I mean, younger people like to know these things.
Well, for one reason, when you're discouraged, to realize that discouragement isn't a necessarily permanent aspect of life.
Okay.
And I think that also the emphasis that we give to the immediacy of events in our active life is good and understandable, but it also has some shortcomings.
So you said before that there's a sort of a cyclicity or cycles, ups and downs, so that one shouldn't just look at the short range, but rather at the long range.
We shouldn't use always the old measurements for changes that are coming.
We should prepare
ourselves to look at the possibility of new measurements.
This is what I consider one of the most remarkable things about you, that you've been able to be so open to changes all the time. Now, I wonder if, you know, for the sake of younger people who are struggling to be who they are, how do you become like that? What is it that makes you able to see into the future rather than to the past?
I'm not sure, but my guess is it may be partly a temperament and partly just the sense of as much civilization as we have, one I'm sure with many ups and downs, is still better than none.
Right.
In other words, whatever the limitations of life, a positive attitude is logical, reasonable, and should be satisfying.
So you found a kind of a sustenance from a historical perspective,
yeah,
by not only looking at things from the current moment, but over longer range?
And I'd add to that the sense of excitement in studying history.
Uh-huh. Where does that come from? What is the exciting part of it?
Because in research, you're never quite sure how it's going to come out.
Right.
And there are many paths to follow, and there's a certain excitement in making little discoveries, even though they're not terribly important.
Well, isn't there also excitement into sort of entering lives that are long gone,
yeah, right,
and you can understand them better?
And in biography, trying to put yourself in the place of the person.
Right. That empathy, the ability to empathize with people out of a different time.
One of my students wrote to me and said, we all have known that one of your chief faults is you have too much empathy, and you put yourself too much in the place of other people. It was in response to the time we were seeing King Lear, and I had tried to blind
myself. You were very upset.
Right.
You were very upset. No, it's true. I think that is a very important, in other words, the ability to empathize. It's one of the values of studying history, that it allows you to enter other lives and thereby to expand your potential for being empathetic.
It can have an unfavorable result if it makes you too uncritical.
Uh-huh.
You've got to maintain some
stance in between, right? That's very interesting. Now, you have said to me that you're an atheist all your life, and you do have a daughter who is a nun, and you have a good relationship with your daughter now. I just wondered if you have any sort of new perspective on religion through that experience and what that would be.
Yes, I do have. I don't know exactly whether I was an atheist. I was brought up in the Episcopal Church, and I liked the ritual, I liked the formality, I liked much about it. But I never had probably any deep belief that everything that we were taught was really true. So I had no break, I just drifted away.
So you're really a Christian, but not a practicing religionist.
But now I've seen in these later years that how much religion can mean to people. And if it can mean to some, then it can mean to more than a few. And
and you don't look down on that interpretation anymore?
No. I think I overemphasize the intellectual aspect of life. There's an emotional aspect of life which is very important.
Uh-huh.
And I think religion is one way of dealing with emotions. And maybe not always, but it can be a good way.
Uh-huh. And are you equating emotions and the concept of something supernatural? Do you believe that there is such a thing as something supernatural outside of what our cognitive senses can perceive?
No, I don't really think so.
You don't?
I don't
okay.
really think so.
I guess that's why I called you an atheist.
Yeah. I don't really think so. I can understand that if one did really believe this, it could be very helpful in life. It
could be comforting.
It could be very helpful.
Helpful.
But I...
But you don't.
I can't do
that. I mean, that, no. So to you, the world that we live in is it. This is it. Right?
It could be better, and religion, some kinds of religion, can help make it better.
Yeah, okay.
And as it has in the past, it's worked positively and sometimes negatively.
Well, as I know you, in the short time that I do know you, you're a person with very strong values, strong democratic faith, strong integrity. Is there anything else that you think is sort of a core belief of yours that you haven't particularly had an opportunity to express in your writing that is important to you?
I don't know what spiritual values are, but I would like to think there's something that I haven't realized.
How about friendship?
I think friendship is terribly important. And
is that something that's become more important to you in old age?
No, it's always been very important. And I've always been reinforced by friends.
Okay, so I think that that's something that we should maybe talk more about. What by friendship, what do you encompass in that concept?
Well, it seems to me that in most lives, that there are struggles and problems just to live. And I think in friendship, the helpfulness each way, each one helping the other constructively, makes life much better.
Is reliability an important aspect of friendship?
Yes.
What else? What do you expect from a friend?
Reliability. Truthfulness, empathy,
non-judgmental sort of acceptance.
Non-judgmental.
Yeah. And you found that many places. You found many friends.
Right.
So you don't you think that you have developed a very good capacity for friendship? That's something that really is an achievement.
I'd like to think so.
Okay. So you didn't mention that. You know, I brought it up. And yet I think it's an outstanding characteristic of you.
Thank you.
Well, it is. Okay, I have only a few more questions. I just want to know how you see the condition of society and the world at this time compared to, you know, the length of your lifespan and the other periods. Do you think things are getting worse? Do you think things are getting better? They're staying the same, or what?
It depends on what.
What?
What measure you?
Well, I mean, let's take yourself at age 50, midlife. All right. When was that? That was in the 50s, right? Okay. How's the world gotten since then?
Well, at many times I felt very discouraged about the drift of things.
Okay.
And looking back, I think at the same time that there were reasons for feeling discouragement, there were also reasons for not despairing.
Right.
So I would like to think that to a great extent, it comes down individually, and then I'll speak collectively. Individually, it comes down to one's ability or success, relatively, in coming to terms with living, friendship, work, and play. Collectively, it's very hard to make an assessment because there are so many differences in social structure. Problems of what seem to be unfairness.
The unfairness in the world certainly hasn't gotten much better in the last 50 years,
no? I don't know about justice, which is related to unfairness. Sometimes I wonder how a civilization ever got the idea of justice in view of all of the unfairness and denials of justice that there are to any observing person, not necessarily intellectual.
Could it be that now we know more about the injustices that are perpetrated through the media that we are in touch with every bloodbath, with every massacre, with everything, that these things went on before and nobody knew about them.
I think so.
You know, that may be a thing for the good, because in the long run, the more we know, the more we're able to act on.
Yes, if you don't know something is wrong,
right,
you don't know anything about it.
Right. I mean, my parents grew up in the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, which gave rise to the bloodbath that we now see enacted in Sarajevo between the Croats and the Serbs. But if you had asked them, there was no problem.
Right.
They didn't know there was a problem,
yeah.
You see.
Right.
And I think that's no longer quite possible in the world. Everybody has the means of knowing. Now, I don't know whether that is an improvement or not, but it potentially could be.
Potentially, it certainly can be.
Uh-huh. So, are you essentially an optimist? Are you a pessimist? Are you something in between?
Something in between.
I like to refer myself to a despairing optimist.
That's a good term.
Or a surviving pessimist. There's something in between,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You said what I would like to have said.
Uh-huh. Are there any other things that you want to talk about that you think are of interest in? On the subject of old age, don't you find, for example, that a lot of people are quite kind, more than you expected, or do you find the opposite?
Yeah, I find people try to be kind.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a surprise, isn't it? I mean,
and tolerant.
Uh-huh.
I think I see more evidence of tolerance at old age than I think I saw in my younger years.
Well, that's a good message, you know. That's something people need to be aware of. I think that's, if that's true.
And ordinary decency.
Uh-huh. That is there, right? May have to do with where we live.
It may, I'm sure it does. the circumstances, I'm sure, must be very important.
All right. Well, are there any other thoughts that you would like to record?
No. Yeah.
No?
You've asked some tremendous questions.
Well, I have enjoyed our conversation.
I appreciate them very much.
Okay, thank you.